Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? Bad.
What? What?
Bad.
No. Why is it bad?
What's bad, internet? I lost the day it was because it's not the day we're recording.
It's right.
I'm going to leave it.
What?
We're going to roll with this. That's what we do. It's Friday, June 21st, not Tuesday, June 18th. You are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 242. That is the right number.
Yeah.
That part I changed on my doc.
Hell yeah.
I did not change the date. I was like, that's wrong. You are listening to Waypoint Radio. We are basically continuing our previous recording session. So, you know, full transparency here. It is still Tuesday when we're recording this. We're answering all of your questions about E3 2019 and about the future of video games. And we asked for questions and we got so many that I was like, we should just keep going. We should just do a second one of these right
Hell
now.
Yeah.
Because I think there's some interesting ones here. I think we got some stuff here where I'm like, I want to answer that. And also, we haven't done a deep dive on the question bucket. And also, Patrick's gone for a week starting tomorrow, or for almost a week. So I was like, let's just sneak this in. I got some dentist stuff this week. I'm going to be out of office on certain days. So, like, let's just fucking knock out this thing. And that way, we don't need to worry about recording on Thursday or Friday. That way, Kato can have all of it in front of him.
Yeah.
You just get them all edited as soon as you want to and free up that week. So let's just dive right into the question bucket. If you have questions, you can send them to gaming. The at symbol, vice, period,
okay.
C-O-M.
That's what we're doing now?
Just this time. Dear Waypoint, says John, like you, I was very excited by the Breath of the Wild sequel announcement. However, since that time, I've seen article after article reporting that the next Zelda sequel is largely inspired by Red Dead Redemption 2. I enjoyed, and then four links. I enjoyed Red Dead Redemption 2, but have complicated feelings about it, as I know some of you do as well. The question is, how should we judge this? What does an RDR-inspired Zelda look like? Thank you, John. And the big thing I just want to hit here is that it's just like, let me pull the curtain back on these different stories about this, the idea that it was reported multiple times. It was reported once. All of this comes from a single
One
interview on IGN in which Aonuma said, so I'm just going to read the quote.
Yeah.
Zelda producer Eiji Aonuma revealed this information in an interview. Sorry, this is wrong. Oh, yeah, this is right. This is the one where it is actually IGN's interview. Revealed this information in an interview with IGN. When asked what games the younger staff and the Zelda team were playing, specifically what inspired them, Aonuma responded, "Something I did hear is that a lot of people were playing Red Dead Redemption 2. That's the quote. The quote is not, and we're looking to that for a huge amount of inspiration.
Yeah.
Or we think that game is amazing and we're trying to do that, but Zelda. And I'm not saying that it will
it's
not be
influential. It's literally a popular video game.
Yes.
With big world and stuff in it is being played by staff making a big world with stuff in it.
In the same way that the Red Dead Redemption
They're
team
doing
probably
their
played
job.
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
Right. So what happens when a story like this hits is that's a great headline. That headline, the IGN
it's
headline.
Zelda and Red Dead Redemption 2, SEO,
swish, huge. And you're a team that's been reporting out E3 for a week, and you're like, you look like Ganon in that Breath of the Wild 2 trailer. You're just like dehydrated. You're just a desiccated corpse. You're about to be looted. Some motherfucker's about to kick down the door and be like, yo, do I get a magic sword from you? You are like, I have to write a thing today. IGN reported this. Is this something our audience cares about? Probably. And that is how you get four stories. I think it's very funny, John's email, the last one listed is the original IGN story. Like all the other ones are people just rewriting that same quote.
Right.
Which is not even presented in any like broader context.
No.
Or like a larger conversation necessarily. Like there's other information there about how like Skyrim was a game that they played. I mean, I guess maybe that is my the answer to your actual question is When asked what open worlds inspired the Zelda team as a whole, he said, quote, when I was working on Breath of the Wild, the director, Hidemaru Fujibayashi, was playing Skyrim. Well, how much did Skyrim influence Breath of the Wild? It did, certainly, but right. How close are those two games in design? So I think when you see a story like this, like, take a deep breath. This does not mean that you're going to, like, see those explicit systems. You're not going to see huge cutscenes in a camp, probably, like the way you did in Breath of the Wild.
But
the
story had like a in a lot of ways.
But what if you could pick up NPCs and have a traveling camp in Breath of the Wild?
That'd be great.
Hang out with those people cool. And like go on quests for them. Mm.
Totally. That'd be
sure,
great.
Steal that part.
And like this is complete conjecture, but I could definitely see someone playing Skyriming up a mountain and being like, what if we could just climb?
What if you could just climb? Exactly. Right? That's the sort of stuff that when you think about inspiration, you really think in a broad terms, especially when you talk about gameplay mechanics.
Yeah.
Because it is often finding gaps and being like, I want to address this thing that is frustrating me in this game.
Right.
Like, I really like this, but XYZ. So I just want to hit that one quick, John. I think that's like, you are, to be clear, I'm not dragging you, because if you see that array of headlines, you're like, fuck, I can't believe they're making Red Dead Redemption 3.
Yeah.
But like, they're not. That is not what that means. It is, as Patrick said, their job to survey the field and be like, wow, here's a game that is trying something.
Right.
We should play this and see what it's doing. And like, how can we bring that stuff in? In the same way that we look around at other games journalism and other podcasts and other, you know, whatever. We're like, huh, cool. This is a big feature that they're doing. I wonder if we have an angle on that. Or if I wonder if how, man, yeah. That's
how would we have done it
differently? Or right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And also there's an absence of information on what this game is. So people are desperate to latch onto anything to tell them.
Yes.
What to expect from. Yes. From it.
This one comes in from Jordan, Jordan C, who says, technically I have two questions, but I'll keep them brief. Did y'all get any hands-on with Silksong, and any further thoughts if you did? If it was mentioned on the E3 pods, I forgot. Sorry. They were long and full of very good content. It's hard to remember every detail. We talked about it in our final E3 podcast, but none of us got hands-on with it, unfortunately. Patrick tried.
It was the only game in that section, Nintendo's booth, that had a line.
Right.
Every other game... you could kind of just scoot up to and get real close on. But, yeah, Hollow Knight had a line. But, you know, I'm encouraged the fact that it's playable. I feel like that game, it was listed as coming soon.
Yeah.
I say this with no inside information. I feel like maybe it comes sooner than we thought. My theory, I think I floated it on the E3 podcast, was that Hollow Knight was a surprise E3 launch.
Last year.
E3 download after the game had been delayed a little bit for Switch. And that I would not be shocked if... summer seems like a very appropriate time for that game to wrap up development, and I won't be shocked if that's also a Nintendo Direct surprise. It's like, and actually, the new Hollow Knight is out
now, or in a week, or whatever.
In a week, like Cadence of Hyrule or something like that. Like, actually, you know what? Don't release it during E3 week,
because
that means I can't play it. What you should do is release it on that Friday, like Cadence of Hyrule.
Yep,
download it
early
and then
enough.
I'm good.
Early at midnight, so we could all download.
Don't
it before
let these
planes.
People just at home who can't play any of these video games, can't talk to these designers, enjoy a video game that week. Don't do that. Release it on Friday for maximum personal pleasure.
Yes. Jordan also says, I don't think I heard y'all mention Phantom Brigade, that wild-ass mech game that looks like a hybrid of Transistor's turn planning, Battletech's mech damage and map view, and Into the Breach's knowledge of what the enemy will do. So, thoughts? That's the same demo that they had at PAX. So if you want to hear us talk about that, go back to our PAX East Kingdom Hearts lore reasons
panel.
We spent 30 minutes of that panel just talking about games and one of those games.
I think we wrap back around on a post-PAX panel as well.
To like, do more of
to
it?
To do more, like a little more of it. But those two.
Those are the two to look for.
Yeah.
That demo was at the Judges Week, and it's the same demo that I played at PAX. Mm. So it's cool, a cool demo.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that game, but like that is the thing that is. This one's for Patrick, because I don't know that we got too deep on it. Maybe we did a little bit. Paul says, I was curious if you got hands-on with Monster Hunter World Iceborne. Did you hunt Banbaro, the giant Tauntaun with antlers, or Tigrex, the yellow and blue wyvern that likes to charge around? And when the game is released, do you think you'll go through the new Master Rank, a.k.a. G Rank, and finish it?
I did. I played an hour. I had a chance to mess with both those quests. Banbaro, who is sort of a giant deer like creature. And there's an interview I just published up on the site in which I talked to the executive producer slash art director and the producer of both World and the new expansion Iceborne, in which they, one of the questions I ask is talking through like how they design a monster. And one of the ones they specifically called out was Bombaro as being like a character where the designers said, you know, it'd be cool is like when an animal, you know, charges you, that it could like pick up, it's like so intense that it picks up the ground. Like it, wow. It just like grabs things. Like, how would we do that? And then that's how they came up with attaching antlers. It's where the designers had an idea and then the artist came up with a solution so that the two could kind of work in function. And yeah, I mean, it plays, I guess, Monster Hunter.
Okay.
You know, like there's, you know, I've.
Did you get to use the hammer? Did you, in that demo, where they like, pick a weapon?
No, yeah, they're like, hey, you know, you can start with, you know, whatever default was, but like God. They let me go in, pick the hammer.
Nice.
And yeah, like that game is still a hell of a lot of fun to play. The Bombaro is a pretty easy enemy. I think it's like an early, even though this is meant to be more end game content, like there's still sort of like a recognition, I think, that a lot of people are going to be returning to the game and cannot necessarily just jump into like a Nergigante like level fight immediately. Mm-hmm. So Bombaro is meant to be sort of like a tutorial level, like, oh, it's an enemy that charges, you dodge, and you just kind of get your sort of compass back together on how you play that game. So I want to say that I'll go back to that game because we got so close to the end. I think we were two fights away from the finish, I want to say, when you, Danica, and I were doing some of the end game stuff in the baseline. I don't know that I'll go back. It kind of, I guess it depends on where like the flow of games is at that time. I don't know that I saw enough here.
Isn't that September?
Yeah, it's September on PS4 and Xbox. I got a lot of questions when I went in for my interview. I asked some people if they had questions, and I got a lot of inquiries about the disconnect between the PC and console versions. Like right. The content has been coming much later for the PC stuff to a degree that is a little odd given. You think it would have been synced up by now? Mm-hmm. They have not announced a PC release date for Iceborne. I didn't get any insight into that part of it, unfortunately. Huh. But you know, it is more Monster Hunter World with like, you know, the chain hook or whatever they're calling it is. It's not on the margins, but it doesn't like fundamentally change the game. So I guess it's sort of like if my friends start playing again,
right?
Like I'll probably jump back in and check it out. But if it comes at a time where, like, I don't know, a shitload of other things are going on, I could see myself being like, I kind of got enough out of the, like, 90 hours I put in the first time and that I'm excited for the sequel, but it may be enough for me until the sequel because I got nothing out of doing the – I want to get full armor sets, like, which is a lot of what you're doing once you've done the base game before they were adding in like variations on monsters and putting in new creatures. Like a lot of just Monster Hunter is you quote unquote beat the game and then you grind for like different armor sets and things like that as both a completionist and also to adapt different play styles. And that's just not like, that's not for me. And so if Iceborne is, you know, it does seem like it's a full area. I feel like they said the base landscape is bigger than the main region in World. It's like the biggest one they've ever developed.
Wow.
So I don't know. I can see myself wanting to give the answer. It's like, hell yeah, I can't wait to get to Monster Hunter. But in my heart of hearts, I feel like I might be checked out until the sequel comes along.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. I like the stuff I see here looks really cool. And if I was still playing that game, I'd be like, yes,
I'd be psyched.
Fucking cannot wait.
Mm.
But it's just like, there's going to be such a busy year. There's so much stuff to play. And part of what needing to play a bunch of games for coverage means is like, it biases you towards experiences that are, one, it biases you to new products, which this is. So like, it should be in the mix. But two, it biases you towards new experiences and designs that you know the audience is really interested in hearing you talk about.
And what's your angle? Like, what am I going to write about, right? Like, so it's like, you know, for me, it's like, okay, if I was going to write about Monster Hunter Iceborne, like what do I have to, like, I already said what I had to say with World, where it's like, oh, I'm a newcomer, like, you know, I've wanted to like this. Like, there's a lot of angles in there, whereas like Iceborne feels like, you know, that's for like the hardcore, like the people who fucking love and are continuing to play this game.
And if we had 15 people, it would be easy for me to be sure. Like, yeah, Patrick, spend the time on it.
But go figure harder. It out. Like you'll find an angle if you go in and play it. Whereas like it's much easier to be like, well, we just had that conversation about Astral Chain. That game comes out August 30th, which is really close to when Iceborne comes out. There might be six new angles on Astral Chain that is more for me to chew on faster than Monster Hunter. But who knows? Like I'm September's a long ways away, relatively
it is.
Speaking.
It is. So September 6th we'll when this is out, right?
6th or 7th, yeah.
6th or 7th, somewhere. Like, yeah, exactly. That same week is also Phoenix Point, that Julian Gollop XCOM game. Like you said, the week before is Astral Chain. I think the week after is Daemon X Machina.
I'll probably still be playing Fire Emblem at that point.
Right.
That game comes out in late July, and I bet that's not short.
Yeah, totally. So there's going to be – it's just like there's a lot all around around it. Gears 5 is in there.
Jesus.
So it's just going to be – it's a big
– there's a lot of August and September games.
Borderlands 3 is in there, which again is like –
yep.
So yeah, there is a lot in that era or in that period of time.
It's
that's
also
gonna make it tough.
It also definitely for me at least it depends a lot on where that is supposed to fall on the like gear leveling thing because there are ranks after where like the monsters hit harder, so you need the better gear, etc. Where like if that's like at the very very end of like all those ranks, I wouldn't even be able to attempt the monster.
Right.
I would love to jump back in and just like try it to see how the monsters are different or whatever and how it feels. But if I'm going to have to grind for like 10, 20 hours on the older stuff, I probably won't ever get around to it.
Man, I would hope not because you would think that it would be designed in such a fashion that there's a lot of people who are like us that like played it for 3 months.
Right.
Fell off, moved on to the next thing. And then Iceborne, which I mean, in a lot of ways is a sequel. Like it's a, you know, they've added stuff along the way, but like rather than doing, you know, region drops, they just said, hey, we'll just do a big ass one time expansion that itself they've already said will have more monsters and updated stuff like probably for another year before we, you know, inevitably get the Monster Hunter World 2, which goddamn, that's going to look cool as hell on next gen platforms. Like I'm ready for it.
Oh, yeah. Hell but,
yeah. I don't know how they're handling the transition for players or if they are at all.
Could you imagine there's ways in which those areas in Monster Hunter World connect, but you can't actually cross. Like there'll be a drop down that starts to get more like rotten that is obviously like in world leading to the next area. Mm-hmm. Imagine if that was all one huge like
space. Well, Iceborne is one big space,
right? I'm just saying like the
if that's
like,
how it worked.
Like if that was
you could start in the ancient forest, go over to the wildland waste,
right?
And
exactly,
like all
like
different
that.
The same connected like space.
Yeah, because like the start to the wastes is a connection to the forest, and you can look behind you and see the forest going back that way.
Right.
That's the thing that I think could be really interesting is if like there's those individual regions become biomes within one large space or something like that. That would be interesting.
I want more like creature edges. Interactions. I feel like
yeah, that
world scratched the surface of like what could be possible, and yet and at some point like it was very cool like for the first like 15 hours when that shit would happen, and then it was just like convenient when you could just take a break and let two monsters fight each other, but it didn't feel like it didn't feel like an organic system anymore. Like it didn't feel like you were in an ecosystem. It just felt like that's just a thing that it's a mechanic.
Yeah.
These two at a certain point. And I'd love if they kept pushing towards building an ecosystem that felt more natural, at least, or gave the creatures more things to do in the spaces while you were running around.
That is the opposite of the thing I mentioned in what is now the earlier this week's podcast about the card game mechanics, and like starting to see the code, so to speak, starting to see the design, is that while on one hand it can make certain like narrative events seem cooler, it can also make certain moments like that seem more programmatic and more like you can see where all the puppet strings are. And that can kind of
And I'm fine with seeing the puppet strings. I just like for them to be more puppet strings.
Yep,
really. Like 100%. Because a game you're going to play 100 hours, you're going to see the hands behind the scenes and how that stuff connects, I would just love more than just the rumble or whatever it is that it's called when, like, the animals run into each other. I just like to see just more of
them
that.
Hunting just, or going out to get more supplies for their nests. Yeah, totally. All sorts of different stuff.
Make me feel even worse for killing them. Is what I'm saying.
That is people should go read your interview
still
with that team.
Well, I killed Nergigante because you can't capture him, but
yeah, killed that motherfucker. See,
yeah,
even you.
That's
you got
true.
Blood in your hands.
I tried my best.
This
they
one,
they, yeah, they did. Yeah, I think you were gonna say they did. Well, I want to, you know, I only have 30 minutes, but I did try to sneak in a question about sort of the approach to violence in Monster Hunter, and the way I framed it was specifically. You know, it's one thing when this game was on like PS2 or PSP, in which the depiction of the creature was like so arcadey that, you know, it felt it was like pretty difficult to like generate empathy for what was in front of you. Whereas like specifically with World, like the leap it took in fidelity is to such a degree that it must be at least a conversation within the team to balance how do you depict them as real creatures when the core loop is about harvesting them, basically. And they talked about that and how they try to approach it in the narrative, and I don't think they're like overly successful or particularly successful at like making that believable. And also things like the arena really undercut, you know, where it's just like, yo, I just really want to fight this monster over and over, so just put it in a fucking arena and let me beat the shit out of it over and over again. But you know, it's not nothing. It is not, though, they don't consider that when they're building the game, even if I ultimately disagree on the degree to which they take it all that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least where they come down on it.
Right, right. People should go read that interview. It's a good interview.
Yeah.
Waypoint.vice.com. This comes in from Liz from Denver, who says, a lot of the E3 discourse, for me at least, has been dominated by Cyberpunk 2077. Just kind of everything about that game, actually. Gender expression and character creation, which is something we didn't actually even get to talk about, but came out of some interview last week, that they are experimenting with options to allow you to pick different bodies and faces with voices from the other gender selection, basically, from not like locking gender selection. Who knows how that will turn out in play. Representation of NPCs in the game, in-world ads that are meant to make the player feel uncomfortable. It's a game playing with a lot of big, complex issues, and that brings me to my question. What's the most successful AAA game that has handled big issues well? They don't have to be specifically the same one Cyberpunk is looking at, but I was thinking about other mainstream games and couldn't think of any examples. So I wanted to see if y'all could think of any. Anyways, keep drinking tea and getting lots of sleep. Doing around 18 hours of podcasting can't be easy, but well done on your E3 coverage. Liz from Denver. Thank you, Liz. Thank you so much. Liz also included a kind note for our tackling of the Cyberpunk stuff, so thank you for that. We try our best. It's a hard question.
The one that I had never played this game, so I don't actually know, but the one that I've heard mentioned in this like vein was Mafia 3.
Mafia 3, the two that come to mind for me are Mafia 3 and Watch Dogs 2, and both of those come out in the same year, which is interesting.
Yeah.
We ran a story at the end of the year that was like, in 2016, big games weren't afraid to bow all the politics, TKTK. The Mafia 3 handles race really, really smartly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the things that it does the best around race and racial politics are mechanical. I think like the inclusion of a cop meter is so good. The idea of like this cop is looking at you because you are black and you are in the same space, even if you are not doing anything, you are having police attention directed towards you is so sharp and terrifying. And is just like a good, is just, you know, a risky thing to include. I think that the game does say things about the racial politics of the 1960s and also the racial politics of today, extrapolating from that. With like the distance of time, I still definitely think that it's mostly kind of a grindhouse revenge flick. A game, rather. It is trying to be that, though. Watch Dogs 2 has some big missteps, I will say. But in terms of having a diverse audience, a diverse set of characters, cast of characters, in terms of having missions where, like, they are straight up talking about things like the low amount of diversity at tech companies and having missions about things that are like companies and political factions trying to fix polls in terms of just like having a sense and an ethos and like kind of a cultural viewpoint. Watch Dogs 2 is actually really strong. I talked about this on one of the pods that I think Josh, one of the characters in the main cast who is autistic, is handled really well. A lot of my friends who are autistic really like Josh a lot and like think that his characterization is really sharp and smart. I know that like I think that just in general their handling of like this is how people are is pretty good.
Right.
There are definitely some missteps. There is a trans character who I think is not great. There's also a trans character who I think is rad. There are characters who I think they like play for laughs in a way that like doesn't work for me, but like they're taking a lot of big swings in that game in Watch Dogs 2. And many of them are things that I thought they would just flub. And I don't even mean in an offensive way so much as like in a way where it just feels like disingenuous or phony or like, hey teens. And it's not. So that is the one that stands out for me in recent memory. I think if you open it up to full time, like there's probably something else that felt right at the time, but I don't know what comes out. What comes to mind, especially when you start thinking about big issues broadly and not just identity, not just like the contemporary political moment. If you start thinking about like those sorts of issues, I bet you can find some like. I haven't gone back and played like the initial Fallout in a long time, but like stuff from that era, Planescape Torment, the games that have like great reputations for general storytelling. A lot of that storytelling is about big cultural thematic ideas that are political in nature, but aren't necessarily one-to-one representative. So I would say like any analysis or answer should be taking that stuff into account and going back to look at those games. But nothing else jumps to mind, and I'm sure someone is shouting something at their thing that just came up.
Also, I haven't played, but I heard it in reference to this as Spec Ops.
Yeah, I'm on the side of history that doesn't love Spec Ops, honestly. The people who I know who love Spec Ops, I get why they like Spec Ops a lot. Mm-hmm. But, like, the big trick of that game is it's hard to get into without spoiling it, and I don't want to spoil that game. But it wasn't that effective for me.
Right.
I think that it has something to say about war. I think that separates it especially from games of that era.
Right.
It's a big swing in the world it exists in. And so I think it got more credit than it probably deserves because of what exists around it, which is also a testament for what it was trying to do because there's a reason that people don't try to make you feel bad.
Coming out that time.
That would have been in the middle of like the height of Call of Duty.
Right.
Right. Yes. Like the height of postmodern warfare, Black Ops era. I'm pretty sure.
Gotcha.
It didn't hit as hard for me as it did for other people, but I have an enormous amount of respect for its audacity given how difficult. I mean, we live in a slightly different era where maybe it would be easier to have something like that made. I don't know, but. I appreciate that it exists, like, profoundly. It, at the very least, it led to lots of really interesting conversations that I don't know that we would have had otherwise, which even if art isn't fully successful, its existence, like, justifies what it attempted to do, totally. I think.
And then the other thing here is, like, once you take away the AAA space, once you take AAA away, you're overwhelmed by answers, right? Like at that point, when you're talking about independent and alternative and like single developer games, there are too many to count because they're all happening things.
It's why I wrote a piece right before E3 about unpacking a sex scene that was in the most recent episode of Life is Strange, which I've shouted out on this podcast as being really good and really relatable. And I had to make sure I got a line like in there, like emphasizing, by the way, this is like it's impressive. I think this is well done. And for the aesthetic fidelity that it's playing with is part of why it's impressive relative to what surrounds it. But you look anywhere in the independent scene, you will find plenty of like very relatable, interesting, realistic depictions of sexual interactions between people so like do not have the takeaway of this be like Life is Strange is groundbreaking because it's the first time we're like showing sex between teenagers in a way that feels real. It's more given this specific context and what we expect from these types of games, it is impressive and thoughtful. But if you're looking for more of that, there are all sorts of text-based, independent-based games that have been thoughtful for many years prior.
Yeah, totally. I think that is one of the biggest frustrations that you can find sometimes in this space is like, and also it can be a frustration that you feel internally, which is a scene like that happens and you want to wave the flag and be like, look at this, they're doing a cool thing.
Yeah.
But also in the back of your head, you're like, it's a cool thing that was done by these 30 games last year by independent creators. And I've, you know, sometimes you've shouted about those too and no one cares. But right. It's like, not that story about Life is Strange was like a barn burner necessarily either, but right. Like people do, you know, it there is a natural bias in the audience too. And it's just like, it can be tough to contend with that and like draw that attention to the real groundbreaking stuff as hard as we try. So next question, this one comes in from Vehemently, who asks us something we've kind of hit on before, but I want to revisit it just to see if anyone has any updated thoughts, you know, a few days away from it. They write, ever since I was a kid, I've been paying attention to E3. My relationship with the event has had a complete arc where I went from young childlike glee at announcements to the eventually jaded 20-something reactions you know today. yes, y'all radicalized folks on the podcast. But when I think about E3, I tend to get a lot of emotions that have nothing to do with video games. The first memory I come to is graduating from elementary school and being struck with a strange melancholy that I was more focused on the new trailers than the new school experiences to come. I've always had a lot of social anxiety, so I didn't see a lot of friends outside of school. E3 is just a distant corporate event, but for me, it is the herald of the summer. And with summer being ushered in, along came with it 3 months of video games, reclusiveness, and air conditioning. Nowadays, when I've chewed through the consumerism and corporate greed, E3 tastes sour and tired. I'm immediately taken back to the slide from spring into summer and the sadness I associate with it. This is all to ask. Considering that y'all have a far more storied history with E3, do you have any associations with the event that have nothing to do with video games? Hopefully less depressing than mine. Lol. What are they and have they changed over the years? Thanks, Vehemently. P.S. Sorry for waxing poetic. I think that's fair. I'm really curious about Kato, who this is your first E3.
Yeah.
I think we have three different eras of this, right? Like I've been nowhere near as many as Patrick, but I've been to more than you, Kato.
Yeah.
So your first one was like my fifth or sixth or whatever. And then it was Patrick's 17th, 15th, 12th. I don't know.
20th, I think.
20th. Jesus Christ. Even my most excessive guess was wrong. So let's start with you, Kato. Do you have any associations, like coming into it, what was your association with E3? And then like, how was it for you? Like, how did it feel?
E3 was always strange because the only part of it I ever really got into were the conferences. And like I almost never engaged with any on the floor stuff, so I didn't actually know what the floor looked like or what that was gonna be like. I actually assumed there would be more of those. There were these random like meeting rooms in like the back corners where people were taking like closed doors meetings. I thought there would be more of that actually on the floor, but it turns out most of that's in other places in the convention center. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, but it was weird how much of a convention it already felt like. Like, even when I go to, like, an anime convention or a comic book convention, depending on the size of the panel, sometimes you're waiting in line for an hour. I mean, E3's lines got up to, like, 3 hours, which is, like, beyond anything I've ever seen at a regular convention, but it was still something that seemed familiar in a way that I didn't expect it to be. But apart from that, it was also weird because, and everyone kept saying this, and even I, having no frame of reference for what the show floor looked like, felt like it was sparse. It felt like it did not live up to any of the expectations I had because I always thought it would feel bigger than it actually did. And this is because it's a thin year and also like, I mean, we keep mentioning that there's like rumors that it might be the last year, even though they did put up numbers at the end, right? Like, see you next year, whatever. What was it, the 9th to the 11th or whatever? But
yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's just weird to go to a thing that feels like it's dying, even though it's my first one.
that is pretty much on point for me. I like growing up, I knew I wanted to do something with games, and my family knew I wanted to do something with games. My dad made it a point year after year to be like, I wonder if we can get you to E3. Right. I know, Patrick, you had a very similar experience with your dad. It never lined up for me. And part of the reason it never lined up for me is because I never really pushed for it. I was always like, I was always someone who was like, I'll make the best with what I got. And I know that, like, this is a, that would be a big ask. Also, I was saving my big ask for if the Eagles ever make it to the Super Bowl, Dad, you have to take us to the Super Bowl. Like, dead ass, that was 100% the thing I was saving my big, Dad, you have to make this happen
right.
for. That didn't happen until I was too old for that request to go through. So E3 had this kind of mythological position in my head until I would say I was in college when I guess the two things I'd point to. One is I remember the year where Microsoft released game demos on the Xbox 360. They released like a Lost Planet demo and something else.
Oh my God,
Lost Planet. Shattered E3 for me because it immediately introduced a timeline for the end of E3. It was like, I don't need to be there. They can just send this stuff. They can just, which is way more simplistic than the truth, which is right. like, no, putting together a demo build for a game is so much different than putting together a build ready for a theater presentation or even a 60-minute hands-on demo. Like, the second you release a downloadable, like, executable, yourself up to so much more.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I was like, wait a second. We could live in a world where none of – and it was also one of the first years where really I was watching the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe not streaming all the way through, but trailers were being uploaded. It was definitely airing on G4. All the major conferences were. And here's the other half of this was podcasts hit. When I was in college, it was from 2003 to 2007. And that is the era where, like, GameSpot was doing podcasts, like On the Spot was really blowing up, and then also the One Up Show, One Up Yours. One Up Show was video, not podcast, but One Up Yours, GFW Radio. Those podcasts were like so influential in me understanding the games industry as an industry, which is something like I like underline all the time. Like it is an industry. I know that like it can be in our most. In our most like aspirational moments, we can want to pretend that it's not an industry and that like we just talk about games as a medium, but it's a fucking industry. You look at E3, that is
well, both
that
can
is,
be true, right?
Both like are true. Exactly, 100%.
The medium exists within an industry. You can treat it on multiple levels.
Good luck creating an artistic industry under capitalism that isn't, or an artistic medium under capitalism that isn't industrialized and turned into, an industry and commodified and et cetera. good luck. If you can do it, God bless. Don't tell me about it because I cover it,
if somebody's
an industry.
Screaming fine art, let
I'll
me
get
tell
the fuck
you.
Out. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely an industry. And so that process of listening to those podcasts, listening to people, on those shows kind of demystify what E3 was. I think a lot about like the poolside. E3 podcasts.
Oh, from the figs.
From the fig on One Up. And the ways in which, and then obviously, as I got older, Giant Bomb's coverage, especially the kind of like couch guests, but even before the couch guests, there was a looseness to all of that, a sloppiness that, and I mean that in the most positive sense, a realness that removed the sheen.
The people there were sloppy as well. Someone that was there.
I've seen those videos. But like, oh wait, these are people who make decisions with big budgets, but they are just people. These are companies that are like trying to sell me a thing. Like that cynicism that vehemently speaks about here, it is not. It does not come from nothing. It comes from an increase in visibility and transparency.
Right.
At like, oh yeah, this is people. They're trying to sell me some shit. Like. That's all this is. Yeah. And it can be fun because you can start to play. You can start to get excited about the gamesmanship of it all. But you have to keep that in relation to, like, what is the purpose. And so for me at this point – so I guess what I'm saying, the actual setup to all this is I went to my first E3, which was, like, as soon as I joined Giant Bomb, like, literally 3 weeks after. Like, I started
– wow.
I started June 1st or something like that, or May 30th, and then went to E3 immediately and was broke as shit. I don't even think one of my paychecks had cleared yet.
Damn.
Maybe one. And it was like, I'm going to go in. I'm going to be cool. I'm going to be whatever. This ain't nothing. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, it was. It was, like, not a big deal, like, because I was surrounded by people who had covered it for years. But to another degree, what I found so surprising was how energized it made me. We've talked about this before a little bit, that, like, I love going to E3 and covering E3 because it puts me in a certain mode. It puts me into, like, finals Austin. You know what I mean? Like, game three Austin. Like, right. I show up to play at E3 in a way that it's hard. The only other time of the year that I ever show up in that way and I feel so energized is Game of the Year season and then Friends at the Table finale season.
Right.
It's like I have to use everything in my body, in my brain to make something work, to make it happen. The reason I can go until I can go to 4 a.m. on a podcast if I had to. And I can find that. And I don't because I realize that's not fair for everyone else I work with. But I could do it and I would enjoy doing it that one week.
Figure out that schedule for next week.
No, dude. No, we should not do that. It's bad. What we should figure out
We should got to figure out the schedule a little better next
year. Yeah, absolutely. We booked we still have 7 people.
Yeah.
We have 4 people.
Yeah.
It is harder to do. Shout outs to Danica for being our fifth person on the bench,
yeah.
our invisible fifth player driving us around this year. But like, yeah, so I had this experience for years where it was like, this is me at my best in some ways, because I'm going to book myself a ton of stuff to see. I'm going to meet a bunch of cool people. I'm going to schmooze. I'm going to like pull out of my, I'm going to be willing to pull down on that battery and like drain my battery all the way, but I'm going to get like a good efficiency rating out of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to be a tiring dinner party where I feel exhausted at the end of the day. And also like, I didn't even really have any good conversation.
Right.
It's going to feel like great. Cause I'm going to see so many people. I'm going to play so many games. I'm going to talk to developers about the stuff they're excited about. I'm going to talk to you, the people listening, and like try to say something thoughtful. And all of that for the last 4 years was like rad. This year, less so. This year, I didn't see that much that I was excited by. If you asked me what my favorite thing I saw was, it would be hard for me to give you an answer.
Star Wars.
I guess, but like by default.
Right, exactly.
And that's not fun.
No.
You know, the stuff that I'm most excited about is out in a month or two. I'm excited for Fire Emblem. I'm excited for Deus Ex Machina, Daemon Ex Machina, which is the play there. But I didn't have that feeling of being, I could still do the podcast all night. I could still go out and like get good meals and go to the Giant Bomb stuff. And like that part of it was still there, but I don't feel rewarded in the way that I normally do coming back from it. I think a big part of that was it's quieter. I didn't see as much. I was so disillusioned by the state of the show where like even in the context of this is a big marketing display, I just don't think it was a particularly good one this year. And so, like, the gamesmanship level is just, like, was low. I don't know. It was tough. And also, we did it with a smaller team. And it turns out doing it with a smaller team means needing to do a little bit more. And in this year, also seeing less.
Yeah.
And that was frustrating. Or hearing about less. So, you know, that is me and my weird arc. Patrick, 20 of them. With that, what do you get out of an E3 like
20?
This one after 20?
Yeah, I mean, my first one, I mentioned this before, my first one was E3 98 in Atlanta. It was the second one in Atlanta. Brad Shoemaker and I were briefly chatting about that as we were reminiscing back. His first one was E3 97, which was the first one in Atlanta. E3 had been in LA, came to Atlanta for, I believe, convention, political, sales reasons, then came back to LA after that. And so E3 is strange for me, like especially... This year was especially sort of strange, like even absent the strangeness of the show as a show. It's more like when I think back to E3 98, you know, that's, you know, my dad got me there. I didn't make an ask as much as I just put it into the world and my parents were weirded out and said, well, we should like support his interests, which is like a pretty incredible thing to have done because I think a lot of that was what set me on the path. For better or worse, that I've been on ever since. And so it's weird to go to E3, think about 20 years. Like 20 is like just such a big number. Like I missed, the only one I've missed in the last 20 years was my first year at Kotaku, in which I joked to Steven Tatil, like, I've been going for so long, I can miss one. And then he told me like, all right, you're not going this year. And I was like, well, wait. Wow. This my fucking streak, bro. He's like, well, we already booked other people. And I'm like, oh, all right, that's fine. And it was fine. It's not, you know, there's, it was no big deal. But, so this one being my 20th, like I, you know, and then coming back 2 days later, Father's Day. Right. Like I've wrote about this a couple days ago that, like I have a very complicated relationship with Father's Day in which, you know, I'm incredibly proud to be part of my daughter's life, but especially before she was around, I think it's been 7 years since my dad passed, in which I cannot help but mostly on that day just be bitter and angry at people celebrating a thing that I don't get to have anymore, and or to have it in a different way without an actual person to celebrate it with. And so like E3 is like thinking of it in those historical terms, like a real weird mix of emotions, especially with Father's Day, like immediately thing that I'm running into when I got back, just because I have such a personal history with the show that is separate from my intellectual or like a broader assessment of like what it means, like vis-a-vis the industry. It's like I owe E3 like a lot of my life, and then I owe E3 like a lot with my relationship with my father. And so it's like I just have a lot tied up in my history with this specific like weekend or week in June. In a way that I'm like, you know, I'm it's a bitter, you know, a sort of a joyous melancholy, if that makes any sense, in which I, like I owe so much to it at the same time, you know, it's very bittersweet to revisit it, sort of that through that long lens of time. But, and in some ways, maybe that's why I'm ready for it to just like fucking close shop and move on, because in some ways going to E3 like just kind of like, you know, gnaws at like kind of an old wound that I don't think about that much during the week because Dustin Walker's keep me up till 2 a.m. talking about video games. But no, I mean, you know, and it's separate from all that. I'm the same way where like I'm so tired these days generally just because of being a parent and not sleeping that much. And, like, on an average week, it's, like, you know, 11:30, and I'm like, whew, I've already – this is too late. I need to go to bed. And E3 week, it's like, nah. Like, actually, maybe if I text someone and they're like, yeah, come out, we're getting drinks. They're like, let's go. Like, I feel like I'm in college again where it's like I could just live forever. And I could only have the energy to do that, like, once a year. And E3 is that week where it's just, all right, I was up till 3. Whoops, I have a 9:30 a.m. appointment. I'll sleep for 4 hours, get up and get in that cab and go. And you find a way to do it. So, yeah, that is, that's E3.
You missed the best meal at E3, by the way, maybe. I meant to tell you this. We went to Pine and Crane, is that what it was called, which is the Taiwanese place.
The Thai place? Oh, I got really
Taiwanese,
good.
Taiwanese, so good.
I got really good barbecue. Thieves, there's a receipt on the ground somewhere.
The floor?
I went to like a really good barbecue joint in LA. So I did have decent food. It was the barbecue joint was well, the food was good. It was surrounded by a Degrassi trivia night. In which very enthusiastic, specifically one very enthusiastic table that seemed I've been to a lot of trivia.
Sure.
But this one table was winning everything. Where it was no longer fun for anybody else at the Degrassi trivia night.
It's very funny.
And maybe that table should have just let someone else win, is the vibe I was getting.
Wow.
Maybe. Maybe sit out one of the rounds.
Was this Horse Thief?
Yes.
There you go. Sounds good. I would go there. That sounds delicious. This one, I'm going to skip, but it... Booker wrote in to say...
Yeah, Booker? What did Booker say?
It's a long email. I'm not going to read the whole thing.
Okay.
But I will just read this one section. Please don't take this the wrong way, but Be Good and Rewatch It is sort of a clunky show name. It's sort of awkward to recommend to people who don't know the original reference. I was wondering if y'all thought about rebranding. now I present to you a new name.
That's what we're doing right now. Oh, what's the name?
Their name suggestion is Watch Good, Internet.
they is replaced a reference with a different.
It's not a bit.
Watch good, internet. Internet.
Watch good, internet. Doesn't roll off the tongue.
There's a long. Does it explain?
Yeah, of course it explains.
That's good.
It also references a beloved catchphrase. It doesn't currently turn up any Google results. I wonder why. It stands alone as a phrase that conveys what the show is about. I'm not saying that Be Good and Rewatch It is like a perfect name, but it does say rewatch right in the name, which helps. Feel the words on your lips.
Tongue.
Feel the words on your lips. What a way to start a show. Watch good, internet. It's me. And then in brackets, Booker has written talent name.
You know what? I do want to hear. XD. I want to hear Rob say,
"Watch good,
watch
internet.
Good, internet."
I can't. I can't imagine.
Insert deep sigh.
So that was. That's a choice. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know what?
Not.
You know what Booker has discovered is branding things is extremely difficult.
It's really hard. It's true.
Which is
really
why
hard.
When you come up with a good one, you cut it out of the podcast and put it in a document.
That document gets getting bigger every day.
I had a good one at E3. I had a really good one at E3.
I don't remember what it is. Fuck.
I'm not going to say it here.
Don't worry about
Start
it.
With a the.
Yeah, I remember what it's about. I just don't remember what the title is. Anyway, that we cut that, right?
I can't. Shit. Which one was it?
It was.
Was it day three?
It was what if we have to do a lore podcast
But was it day
else?
Three?
Yeah.
Who could say?
Yeah, it was the last one.
It was the last one?
So definitely didn't pull that shit up. That shit's out there already.
Shit's out
so
there.
It made that
I'm
podcast.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I missed it.
It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Let's keep moving here. Willie from California with a short, shorty but a goodie.
Hit me.
Did the gamers win?
I saw another one on Twitter. That's close to this also.
Yeah.
Is E3 for the gamers?
E3 is definitely for...
Yeah, think about that, though, actually.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's for the gamers.
I don't think it's for the gamers.
Look, I don't know if the not gamers yet. Won, but I know that Elon Musk lost, and so, you know what? I'll
you
take
what?
What I can
God
get.
Bless. Finally a victory for everyone.
Nier is so many things. Oh. And it's also this now. Thank you. Thank you, 2B.
Thank you, 2B. God. Glory to mankind. people should play Nier. Nier is good. Nier Automata is good. This is a suggestion from Craig from Philly. Hey, Waypoint Gang. It sounds like the show floor this year is particularly underwhelming compared to past years. Companies like Sony and Nintendo have moved away from doing big theater-filling keynotes, instead choosing to stream a series of announcements directly to fans. To make up the difference, it seems like the show is shifting the focus to consumers from manufacturers and retailers. So my question is, what if E3 happened every few years rather than every year? With PAX likely a better fit for the player-focused hands-on expo role, do we really need the business side of things to gather together annually? What do you think would be the pros and the cons of such a change? Keep up the great work, Craig from Philly. My gut here is like...
There's a reason you do things annually because things can be... plugged in based on what companies have ready, and the idea of like planning out 2 years what you're gonna show marketing wise is just not. Companies think on an annual basis in terms of how they
and so
run their
do
companies,
investors
because that's how right and that and specifically that's how investors work, and so and even the the investors that run like the Los Angeles Convention Center, like everything just runs on an annual cycle. So I understand where they're coming from. They're like, yeah, maybe it would make sense every 2 years.
Make it the Olympics.
Not...
Make it, yeah, totally.
Right.
Totally. There's so
or
much
a generational
else.
Thing. Every 5 years we get together for
That'd
E3,
be sick.
But
I would
no.
love a super E3. We get those.
Sure.
Those are just good E3s.
Right.
Which this one was not necessarily.
Right.
Somebody else did write in related to that actually and said a lot of stuff for early 2020, this is from Corey, a lot of stuff from early 2020 was announced at this year's E3. Is this indicative of everyone trying to get their last games out for the console generation, for this console generation, before we get new boxes next fall/winter? And if so, should we be expecting a lot of the launch lineups for the new consoles next year? I think it'll be actually a pretty strong launch lineup for these consoles because of
I think
the
a lot
continuity.
Of these games are going to be like pretty mature relative to.
Right.
I mean, that was true of the PS4 and Xbox One to a greater degree than if you remember the lineups for like the Xbox 360, you know, PS3, stuff like that. I think at this point, the cycle is such that, this is not inside information, but like, are you going to be shocked if. Like Horizon Zero Dawn 2 is announced next E3 and comes early 2021. You're like, wow, that's quick for a, you know. It's like, well, it's not. That game came out at that point 4 years ago. that actually, you know, makes sense for where it would drop. So I will say, informed speculation, that like when I was chatting with someone who would know about, well, maybe E3 just won't be around next year, and they were like, there's a shitload of stuff that's going to get announced in here that people are going to lose their minds over. And I've heard that specifically related to Sony twice, that they're Sony is holding back a lot software-wise that
right.
people are going to be excited about. So
yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, super curious to see how that all shakes out. I think next year's E3, if there is a next year's E3, which they've announced dates for,
yeah,
we'll see.
There will be an E3 of some, like,
there will whatever. Be events. There will be an E3 next There will year. Be the broad category of thing, which is a focused
there will
time.
Be a week.
There will be a week mm-hmm. where people are at a place, where people are seeing games. What configuration that looks like, still to come. I'm not betting on and E3 I, as it is being
E squared C.
You know?
The Electronic Entertainment Conference.
Has anyone gone back to see if there were E3 dates announced before the Santa Monica year? Do you know what I mean?
I don't.
Like,
yeah,
did they
right.
say, we'll be back next year, baby?
I don't remember.
Or did that get announced as the end of E3? We'll have to look it up. I'll have to do that.
Did you see the Fanbyte tweet about the dates?
No.
They just took a picture of the like, see you next year with the comment, with the caption, what is dead may never die.
Good. Great. Perfect.
Fair. I'm excited for next year. I love fucking console cycle.
Yeah.
That's fucking, like my favorite. Yeah. Of, you know, of It'll covering be... video games, like covering video games, like yeah. the part of my job that I do. Man, next year is going to be so much fucking fun.
It's going to be weird, man. It's going to be, oh, they're going to make promises on stage. They're going to be shade thrown.
I love it. Let's go.
Sony needs to have a killer year this year to get them into a place where that stage presentation is going to be exciting.
Right.
In terms of just like building up rapport again, in terms of like, it has been a few years since they had people on stage that could talk about what the Sony PlayStation meant. Do you know what I mean? Whereas mm-hmm. that is all Microsoft has been doing for the last few years is like, hey, we fucked up. I'm trying to delete it. But we're fixing it.
They deleted the fucking Kinect. So,
they
you sure, know, it's working.
They did. Here's a quick one from Dennis. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but Dennis wants to know if we had a chance to look at The Sinking City. That's out this month, so we didn't look at it at the show floor. We'll have coverage of that later this month. So I just wanted to hit that really quickly. Joel from Illinois says, Sony not being there complicates things, but did you get a sense of which platform is more actively pursuing indie devs? I'm guessing Nintendo, but mostly based on Cadence of Hyrule and a sizzle reel in their presentation. Love to hear your thoughts. Thanks. I think it depends on what you mean by pursuing, because Microsoft is very interested in acquisition.
Yeah.
I think part of the arc of like indies this last hardware cycle is that Microsoft wasn't particularly interested.
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of like, hey, fuck off, after indies had been a huge part of bolstering the Xbox 360's success. PS4 was very welcoming. It was an easy platform to develop on, and they had a lot of like outreach. They were going to developers being like, we want you on our platform. We want you on our platform first. We want you with exclusive content here. We're going to pay for the rights to do that.
Yep.
And then about mid-cycle, when Sony sort of established their dominance, they said, but what if we were more like Microsoft and we didn't care so much about that stuff and we're just a de facto market leader? And then Nintendo came in and sort of adopted more of what Sony had been doing before, what Microsoft had done the previous generation, in which they were doing a lot of active outreach, and the Switch is just a platform where people are ravenous to buy games.
Yeah.
Like, I would not be shocked if the attach rate on Switch is significantly higher, especially right now, relative to other platforms, which is why I think you see indie developers prioritizing Switch in a way that is both reactionary to Nintendo and their outreach, and them putting indie games on the same stage next to, you know, Breath of the Wild 2 or whatever, but is also just a financial thing. I think while it is harder for games to break through, it is still the case that if you have to make a bet on any of the platforms, like if we could choose one where we think we might take off, Switch continues to be like your best bet if you don't get a check from Epic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so curious to see how it's kind of building off a number of questions that came in, how game streaming and also Game Pass are going to interact with these specific types of like small indie games. Because you look at something like Void Bastards and Outer Wilds coming out on Game Pass last month, this month, whatever day it is.
It was last month.
I don't know that that's true.
Are you sure? It wasn't end of May?
I couldn't tell you anymore. It's all blur to me.
What are months?
What are days?
I mean, that's the May sun 29th. Goes up, sun goes down.
That's Outer Wilds, yeah. yeah, so yeah, the I'm curious how those will interact. If mm-hmm. The thing I'm most curious about with something like Game Pass specifically is, what are those rates like?
Right.
Is that sustainable? And more importantly, is it sustainable long term? Because a lot of times what happens in a situation like this is you sign that deal now to start building out your catalog, and these early deals are really good. You know, people jump at the opportunity to be part of that and get eyes on their stuff. But long term, do those rates hold out? Does it continue to be fair in the long run? Or once there's a library and a lot of internal stuff happening, do those rates continue to be good? And also, how long does that stuff stay on the platform? Like,
yeah,
we haven't had the major thing yet of a well-loved game leaving Game Pass or being pulled somehow from PS Plus, because PS Plus doesn't work that way, right? PS Plus specifically gives you those games month to month. I mean, gives you a license for those games month to
only
month.
Only if you click through and actually get it too. Yes, so. Yes,
totally. But like, that is the – we're going to have that happen at some point. We're going to have some game that's beloved be pulled from one of these services. And that will be a big test of like what we think about those services at the time. That's a fun thought experiment, at least. We did not – none of us played Fall Guys, right?
No, but should we take a break?
Let's take a break while I Google what the fuck Fall Guys is. We'll be back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fall Guys Ultimate Knockout flings hordes of contestants together. Oh, this was at the PC Gaming Show. Or at the Devolver. It was on the Devolver show.
Devolver was a
show. It was at Devolver. This is the least Devolver-y game, though. It's very bright and colorful. Hmm. It looks like Takeshi's Castle or something.
Oh, yeah.
It's bright
and
colorful little
or as it's known in the States, extreme. What is it? MXC,
most extreme
elimination challenge.
Yeah. Fall Guys Ultimate Knockout flings hordes of contestants together online in a mad dash through round after round of escalating chaos until one victor remains. No, I'm sorry, Kip, we did not see that game.
So it's a battle royale game.
Game show. It's like it's a battle royale game show game.
Huh.
All right. Here's a good one from Darren. One question that I don't think you spent too much time on during E3 was the issue of Shenmue 3 announcing its Epic Game Store exclusivity. To give some context as to why I asked this question, I'm not a big PC gamer and predominantly play mostly on console at the moment. That said, when I look at the discourse around Epic Game Store, I see one that engenders a lot of ill will toward the platform from PC gamers. Whilst I've taken some time to understand some of the reasons for this ill will, such as an always-on requirement for using EGS, some of the criticism seems like the somewhat new platform of EGS doesn't have all the features of Steam. In some cases, this could be a problem, but in the instance of a completely single-player experience like Shenmue, it seems disingenuous to discredit a new competing platform for not having features like communities or messaging. Additionally, I would have thought that the main thing Kickstarter backers wanted from backing Shenmue 3 was Shenmue 3, not Shenmue 3 on Steam only. Would the crew care to expand on their own thoughts on this debacle and whether or not they believe the outrage is justified? Thanks. And that comes in from D. The Epic Games discourse right now is so exhausting to me.
With the Shenmue thing, you backed it. Yeah, people back for a platform. You paid money,
yes,
and you were told, I back this to get it on Steam. And Steam, especially now more than ever, is a specific platform choice as opposed to just the PC place. And so I have a certain sympathy for people who are like, I gave you my money to play it on Steam. Partially because, maybe, I like all the stuff that Steam has built in. Look, let's say I have my Steam Link. I want to play Shenmue on my PC, on my TV. I have my setup here. You can do that through the Epic Games Store, just for people who don't know, because I figured this out with Outer Wild, is that you can launch a non-Steam game with some trickery to make it work on a Steam Link, so you can still play it on your PC through Steam. But anyway, that's all just to say, like, there is a certain infrastructure to Steam, as flawed as that platform is, as many frustrations as I have. I don't blame people for saying, I paid for money to get it on Steam. Now you're saying, because you cut a backroom deal 3 years later, because this game is way more expensive than you claimed it was going to be at the start, now it's just on Epic. And the response has been poor, right? Like, they put out a statement, I think, a couple of days ago that was to the effect of, we've heard your concerns. We're looking into it. And it's like, okay. Like, that means you didn't really think this through. You kind of just thought, like, cool. Hey, like, no, you just be happy with the code that you get. And, you know, that's
Shenmue 3. Be happy it's existing.
Right.
God.
I will say,
unattributed
quote, because I don't know how this person will ultimately portray their impression of the game in their respective outlet, but just talking with a colleague in the industry who saw that game at E3, their takeaway was, that was the worst demo I have seen at E3 in the last 3 years. So
I wish I would have seen that demo now. So
yeah, I do. That's the biggest endorsement you could have ever given for me to want to go see Shenmue 3, a series I have no attachment to. But yeah, you know, I mean, I will admit to a little strangeness over it's like, okay, like it's so, and somehow as a reporter, I like transparency. Yeah. I like the fact that it's just like, yo, we're taking a check and we're going there. We don't know how much that check is. So on some level, it's not transparent, but it's like, it is a purely like monetary transaction that is purer than like what happens like with, say, you know, like Destiny exclusive raids and weapons where like there's a, they call them co-marketing agreements in which they are paying for exclusive content, but you're not like paying for the funding of like a weapon. You're agreeing to like put X amount of marketing dollars behind something in exchange for.
Yeah. You're literally buying
on that platform
advertising time. You're literally saying, hey, we're going to pitch in with getting the, we're going to help market this game and put it on.
Destiny will be at the PlayStation.
Right. But also
E3 conference in return.
And also in the NBA finals.
Right.
But that's literally where that money is going. Right. Is like the like television dollars. And that's where there's like the PlayStation logo at the end of that stuff too. Right. It's like, we're part of our big marketing spend this year. It's so weird. Like I think that we could do a three-hour podcast just on the Epic Game Store Steam stuff that is so big to get into, especially because when you start to unpack a lot of it, it ends up going to some places that are like, it's a lot of people like what they like. They like what's familiar. Mm-hmm. And then it's often a lot of people reaching for some shit where they are not thinking where they are reaching. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of like weird racist undercurrent around China with the Epic Games Store that is like rough, that people are like, I just don't like it. And it's because Tencent, it's all Tencent money. And it's like, please listen to yourselves, please. There is also real feature discrepancy. Sure. Also, I have come out and said before that I think some of the stuff that's planned for the way the Epic Game Store is going to work around things like what do you call it?
It's the creator stuff, right?
The creator stuff specifically. It's like there's a specific word that I'm thinking that I'm trying to find. Affiliate stuff. The affiliate stuff like weirds me out, and I don't love someone who creates content in this space.
Yeah.
There's stuff that I think is worth being like, I understand why a person would have a preference. That is what I get 100%. I get why you're like, I don't want to open
another. My friends are here.
My friends are here already. I wish this thing was on this other thing I already use.
I already got to open fucking Uplay.
Right.
I want another one.
But that's the thing. But also, I already opened Uplay. I already opened Origin.
Yeah.
It's my preference
it's not,
is playing
it's
a game
It's not that
well.
Big of a fucking leap.
It's not that big of a leap.
Like when we start breaking it down, they're like individual arguments. And I'm like, okay, yeah. Okay, yes, okay. So I can see how that'd be annoying. But like at the end of the day, yes, like it often feels like people complaining about some shit that's like,
bro,
realize how good you have it right now. Like this, you got to find something new to be upset about in a way that I just can't.
Well,
you know, I'd be curious if someone wants to write in, and maybe you are one of these people. Maybe you
write
could maybe articulate it.
You know what?
Austin doesn't want to see it.
You know what I'm going to do is hit delete. I don't care. I don't. Like, I've read those takes. I've read the takes. I read them.
I'm trying to find, is there a version of it that doesn't just feel like people whining to a degree that I just do not have the time for? Where it's like, on one hand, you can be like, okay, yeah, I get it. And on the other, be like, well, come the fuck on. Like really? Like, this is what we're spending our time?
Again,
like,
I understand preference. The thing that I want to underscore is I understand preference. The thing I don't understand is being like, oh, I'm not going
to
buy this game
now.
Or
being lied to, right? Like, being like, I paid for a thing.
Yes, 100%
with you.
And
then it's over here. That's all understandable.
That fucking sucks. It sucks. But also, if I was a Shenmue stan, which I think you need to have been to pay money for that Kickstarter, because that never looked good, and I was like, fuck this. Like, I can't, if I can't play it on Steam,
I'm
waited
off
22 years and I'm gonna wait 22 more because that's how long it's gonna take to get on Steam. I'll wait as long as it. No, just go fucking play it on. Yeah. And also, the other half of this is like, it's not like Valve is this pristine company.
No.
Like, no, your friend one day is the villain the next until cycle goes all over anew. And I still like in a 1,000-foot view of it, you know, let them fight is how I look at it.
Yep.
Like I'm glad some developers that are smaller are getting fucking paid because the ecosystem on Steam got to a point where that was really difficult ecosystem to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, hey, you can get that check, you know, go get paid, you know, for that year or 6 months or whatever the exclusivity that you signed. Good for you, I guess. And also, like, Steam has needed a punch in the nose, and I like that there's a little blood on their shirt over this, and I want to see that will ultimately, I think, we'll look back in 5 years and be like, yeah, okay, there was a lot of annoyances, but ultimately, hopefully, it resulted in something better for the industry, like the capital I industry of like how these games are sold, released, distributed.
Fuck it, let's all go to Itch.
Let's all go to Itch. Let's all go to Itch. Itch is great.
Yeah.
Shout outs to Itch. Toshkin writes in and says, is Watch Dogs Legion surveillance state posed as an equal aggressor towards all citizens? Does that create erasure of the way immigrant brown/black, queer/trans, Muslim peoples are terrorized today by the security state and would be more so in any fascistic regime? This is going to be one of those questions where it's like, I think it's a great question to have going into that game to look to see if it does that.
Right.
I do know that that's a game that seems like it wants to tackle deportation as like one of its core topics, which to me suggests that in the narrative, maybe they will talk about this. But I'm curious if in the gameplay systems that comes up at all.
Well, right. Like, so for example, I remember in all the demos at E3 that people played that Austin and I spent an hour with, you started as, I forget the older woman's name.
It was a different woman for everybody. We all did get a different older woman.
Right, okay. Oh, right, because it randomly
generates.
That game. Anyway, so the older woman that you've seen in the marketing in the reveal trailer from E3. I remember us internally remarking like, oh, I wonder if the levels of the game's awareness of the look of a character, the appearance of a character, will take into account if you're playing an elderly woman and let's say you're doing some sneaky shit, are you just, is the systems of the game less likely to raise suspicion over an elderly woman doing something that, you know, a young kid, you would immediately like start like zeroing in on? And the developer said, no, like the systems do not work to that level. My takeaway from that is that the answer to this question is probably no. I think you're right, Austin, that it will probably be addressed in the broader narrative. I don't know that, like, if you play,
it's not going to do the Mafia 3 thing.
If you play, if you play a brown person of like Middle Eastern descent, that I don't know that the game is going to be like, hey, by the way, like, you've got hack plus 20, but also like racist plus 5, and it means that like people are around you, like that's
the stuff that it is doing. This one place where I think it could do it. So the two things that come to mind for me, one is, there is the stat for how likely someone is to be pro-DedSec. And one of the things they talked about was like, hey, this person's job is that they're a corporal in the military. That predisposes them to having a low perception of DedSec. They do not by default like DedSec. Unfortunately, they don't go so far in the build that we saw to be like, and also some people are never going to be anti-authoritarian because they are in fact authoritarian and, you know, saving them from their...
Look, if we just debate them in the marketplace of ideas, eventually we can turn them over to our side.
God, it's not even that. Like, this game is literally, what if you cleared their debt for them?
Right.
What if you, like, sped up
their... opened their eyes to the true evils that they've been blinded by because they're part of the system.
I would love... if it was even debate me, bro, I could understand the ideology at underneath it, where it's like, the ideas prove themselves. But it's not. Anyway, the point is, that corporal in the military is predisposed to dislike DedSec because military people are predisposed to dislike them, which I think is like, yes, good. The other half of that is, some people are predisposed to liking DedSec. Some people are predisposed to being, you know, pro overturning all this bullshit.
Yeah.
And I could imagine recent immigrant, or like coming from an immigrant background, or being a queer person. Like, one of the characters I played as was someone who had anarchist leanings like listed in their things, and that made them by default, he was default pro DedSec.
Right.
I didn't need to do that much to bring him on board. And also, like, he looked like a punk. Do you know what I mean? He had like a mohawk and like a cool leather jacket and etc. So I think there are some of those intertwining systems on that layer, but I do not think that they will be that second layer of like, and also it affects your gameplay in these ways. This actually came up in the Empire of Sin demo too, where the Empire of Sin team, which again is the kind of like mobster grand strategy / tactics game that Rob and I saw, wanted to say, like, one of the things that they said was like, hey, we're basing all of our playable characters on either well-known gangsters from the era or fictional characters that represent the tensions around gender and race of the time, which is to say that, like, there are going to be more women gangsters, there are going to be more black and brown gangsters that you can play as like mob boss leaders than the ones that have been recorded in history.
Right.
And one of the things that Rob and I talked about with them was, okay, like, but if you're playing as the black mobster, can you still recruit the Italian mobsters? Are there mobsters who are like, no, I'll never work for a black person? Are there mobsters who are like, no, I'll never work for a woman? And that is – their answer was like, no. Their answer was like, no, we didn't want to move into a simulation of racism in that way.
Right.
Even though that would be more accurate because – and it felt like they were kind of like, because we know our lane. Because what we want is there to be diversity.
We're not trying to say something specific about these.
From all walks of life to be able to play someone who takes out a razor blade and slits their rivals' throats. But what we don't want is – for then someone to use a slur. And I think it takes all kinds of games. I want the games that explore race as a system, racism and misogyny and homophobia and transphobia, et cetera, as systemic issues. Mm-hmm. I also want games where, like, as a black person, I can sit down and not be like, have people call me slurs immediately.
Right.
It can be exhausting. Even a game like Mafia 3, which I loved, I wrote a preview feature before that feature was like tuned all the way, in which, like, yikes, like, I have been called nigger way more times in this game than I have this year. You know what I mean? Which is an achievement.
Sure.
So I think that's we'll see. That game's out next March. There's still some time to start tuning and stuff.
Right.
I really hope that team has listened to a lot of that feedback and is like eager to think through specifically for me, the big issue that I keep coming back to on Watch Dogs Legion is the idea that just like some people will see themselves materially benefiting from authoritarianism and think that that's a good thing.
Right.
They just will. And like maybe that's already in the design doc somewhere, that the big third act turn is that you've secretly been, you know, invaded by a bunch of fucking counter agents. Who knows? Ugh. But if it is just like anyone in the world can be recruited to resist.
Yeah.
Like I would love to, class consciousness, baby.
Right.
But that you have to really fucking earn it if that's the case. And the systems that are there right now don't show me that exactly. So,
I mean, it was that bad that like I assumed that you couldn't until I saw it in that demo.
What's that?
Well, that you couldn't recruit.
You could recruit anybody.
Enemies, yeah, that would be enemies shooting at you.
No, like, you could recruit them.
I know, that's wild. Yeah, yeah.
You might have to put in the effort, right? You like really you gotta like go into the tree out like, yeah. Oh, what can I do to, you know,
since maybe you shot
them, maybe you knocked them out, which was them in the hospital, then you prioritize their treatment and it says like love from DedSec. Right. I don't know how exactly that's conveyed.
That's what it says. It says that. A little card shows up. Right. As they're getting surgery, and they read it, and it's just the DedSec logo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, love, exactly that. Speaking of love.
Much love.
Much love, dog. Alex writes in and says, unfortunately, it got derailed by the fun 14-year-old Patrick does an interview riff, but I want to know what you thought of the Blair Witch game.
I didn't see the gameplay. That was the whole thing.
Is it you didn't see any gameplay? Dude, I was in a haze.
What was last week?
When we talked about it in the last podcast, I said that I don't want to say anything from this game, but at my meeting, the outline, oftentimes when you book an E3 meeting, sometimes you'll say, hey, you got 30 minutes, and you don't know what's going to happen when you get there. You just show up and you wing it. Sometimes you get like a detailed breakdown of like 10 minutes presentation, 20 minutes like Q&A, 20 minutes presentation, blah, blah, blah. And this one said like 10 minutes of like watching like the sizzle reel or whatever of gameplay, then 20 minutes with the developers. And I was like, cool. And I get they rightly assumed probably that I would have just watched that gameplay from the E3 showcase, and I didn't because I would like to boot that game up and just like experience it. Like I now that I know
is
it
that
exists.
Dated?
Yeah, it's I think it's also August 30th or late soon. August or something like that.
All the big games,
which is part of the reason why I didn't want to watch anything. Like this game was like spring of next year. I'd be like, cool. Like I'd like to get a sense of it so I can talk about it, speak to it. But you know, in a world where like I could get code in like you know 2 months, you know from now, like for mythology that means so much to me and one that I was so immersed with in my youth and one that when I revisit, I still like get really excited for in a way that is reflective in Danny O'Dwyer put up a tweet today in which they have a very good filmed perspective of me having a reaction to that reveal, which I actually think in the post E3 lull, my reaction to that game in the spoiler discourse, I think is fascinating to think about in terms of like where I where I fit in terms of how I cover games. But so I managed to interview those developers for 30 minutes without having seen the game, but I mean, I teased it out like talking to them and I pieced together basically what that gameplay was. And it fits very much within what you'd expect from Layers of Fear, which is Layers of Fear, you know, is built on like aesthetic repetition and like, you know, like trickery in terms of the visual. So Blair Witch fits that as a series that is built on time loops and things like that. So So I didn't see it, so I can't tell you what I thought of the gameplay, but I was like talking to the people, especially the writer who's spent most of my time kind of grilling. They seem like very thoughtful about what they're trying to do with it. And so I remain deeply curious, but hopefully the first you'll see of that is, I don't know, maybe I'll do some sort of live stream where I'll actually experience that with folks. That seems
that'd
like a game
so
special
good.
Enough to,
I would
to
love
bust
to
out
see
a,
that.
A horror stream. So
100%.
Catch me in August.
There's time loops? In Blair Witch Mythos?
So like the notion is like, why can't you escape the forest? It's not because they weren't smart enough to just go in a line and find their way out. It's that the witch or the forest or however, they're like varying interpretations of like how that actually works out, has control over like your perception of the forest. So the reason you keep walking back in is because you've actually can't leave. You're sort of, once you walk within the circle of
influence,
you are.
Can I get out if I...
I mean, you don't, you know, it didn't work out well for the people in the 90s movie or in the one that came out a couple of years back.
Has anyone escaped ever?
Okay, well,
wait. How do you get
the
footage?
You want to talk about the rust... Hmm?
How do you get the footage out? Someone had to find that footage.
It's not as though the witch needs to choose you as a target.
Oh.
So it's like you can be within the sphere of influence and nothing can happen. So
the witch can be like, the premise of the
yeah, yeah. Or maybe they're, you know, dormant.
Busy.
I don't know the exact specifics of the life cycle of the witch necessarily.
I'm just
going
to go to Google and type in how does the Blair Witch work?
Well, it depends on if you're talking about the first movie or the second movie, because the second movie gets deep into the physical manifestation of the creature. In the first one, like, the police recover, like, the videotapes from that they filmed, because they went to the basement of Rustin Parr, who killed the children, who made the kids face the wall.
Rustin
anyway,
Parr
so.
You can't do that bit again.
No.
Quora over on Quora.
Sure you can. Kata was like, nobody's going to remember that fucking bit from last week because they were tired, so I'll just roll that shit out a second
time.
Try to
sneak it out. Over on Quora, is the Blair Witch real? Asks Anonymous. Answers here from Nick. Haha, no idea, friend. Only witch I know personally is a space witch. We got a good answer here.
Wait, who are they talking about?
No idea. From Athena. Athena says no. Actually, no movies are. Some documentaries, sorta.
What a good answer, actually.
You know, yeah.
Marie says, I think the story has some truth behind it. Which.
Hell yeah.
Really good. Is really good. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. I like this question that came in, which answers a previous question from a different person. Ian writes in and says, do you think E3 could be a virtual event one week where every publisher does the game releases from wherever they want to be? Then the following week, everyone comes together to a location for everyone to play the demos and communicate with devs and publishers? Or do you see it ending and going to each company having their own pressers? Love what you do. Keep it up. That's a possibility.
So put Judges Week at the end.
You put Judge... It's just... No, where it's like a fan week still. You could still E3 as it stands, but you just do a week. This is kind of E3 already.
Right.
For us, if you don't attend the press conferences...
Right.
And it's just directs, basically. It's just that those directs are in a room. It's like, what if in the Nintendo Direct, sometimes they cut, instead of to just Doug Bowser on a screen, they cut to a room filled with people watching the Nintendo Direct? That would be what it's like. Get one or two more in, and then we'll wrap it up here. Corliss writes in and says, when talking about Wolfenstein Youngblood, it was briefly mentioned that enemies now have health bars. Could you talk more about that? My worry with health bars is that even basic enemies would become bullet sponges. Does it feel like it takes a similar amount of time to kill your average Nazi compared to previous games? And or did it feel like it required both co-op partners to concentrate on one enemy at a time? Really just the boss had the health bar. I think regular enemies died
pretty
normally
So there are, so at least I found them, again, I've admitted that my co-op partner was not particularly good, so it was hard to tell where this particular complaint falls on the spectrum if you were playing either by yourself with, like, competent AI or with, you know, someone that you knew that you could properly coordinate with. But there were, like, tank-style enemies who just came out with a... So, like, there's health, and it's red, and then there are these blocks.
Yeah, you're right.
These white blocks that represent their armor. And there were... It was literally, like, there's no trick here. Like, you just need to... fucking shoot them enough times until those white blocks chip away. And then once they're at the health level, basically if it's just red, it's like really quick to bring them down. Like in the average, if you were to take away the health bar, you would not notice it was any meaningfully different than playing a previous Wolfenstein game. Mm. But by virtue of being an RPG, there are enemies that are going to essentially be bullet sponges to some degree. And so some of these tank enemies were absolutely like that. Whether that ends up being like a actual problem over the course of the game as like you get higher level, I don't know necessarily. But I don't know that I even like didn't enjoy those bits. It was more just it was different, but it does have elements of that for sure.
I mean, there were mini bosses in the earlier Wolfensteins as well that had more than your average health, right? Like just enemies.
Yeah, and in some ways, I like having the health bar because.
Right.
you know, more information. Well, not more information is better, but like it is, it's, I find it satisfying to watch the health bar go down. It was actually, it's funny not to talk about the Monster Hunter interview again, but like that was something that came up in our conversation. Was I remember asking the developers if they noticed anything about Western audiences versus like the game they'd been designing for 15 years, largely for Japanese audiences. And they said they did playtesting before World came out. And one of the first bits of feedback they got from Western players was like, yo, we need damage numbers. Like, I want to know, like, the fuck is going on here? So yeah, they added damage numbers. Yeah. But then, or at least, like, more ways of, like, displaying what the player is doing. But Western players also wanted health bars. Like, they wanted to see, like, literally what was happening on screen. And I think Capcom concluded that actually part of the magic to what makes Monster Hunter work is that ambiguity and having to watch what the creature does, but also just the stress of not knowing if you're one hit away or 100 hits away. Mm-hmm. And so they resisted the temptation to put in a health bar because they felt like that was a step too far, but it was something that Western audiences in particular were looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And I think that there's like a degree to which I think that is. Can you turn those off in Monster Hunter? The number dealies.
Not sure.
I don't know.
Damage I wonder numbers? If you'll be able to turn off. Yeah, because some games let you turn those on or off. Right. I'm curious if you'll be able to turn off the health bars in Wolfenstein. Hmm. Let's see. I want to go out on a good one. Here we go. This one comes in from Finnan. It's our last one. What are your hot takes of the industry right now? What I mean by that is, do you think 2020 is shaping up to be a more progressive year for gaming with lots of many exciting games, or are we stagnating in scandals and weird publishers still? I don't have a hot take here, except that, like, the industry is the industry. Mm. There is very little new under the sun in terms of the stuff going on behind closed doors. Like, are there going to be more labor scandals? Yes. Are there going to be more, like, bad sexual misconduct scandals? Yes. But the answer to why that is because those things have existed in the industry and are only coming to light now because reporters are able to speak to people. People feel more comfortable telling their stories because there's been a wave of that stuff happening. The stuff that does feel genuinely new is seeing, like, Bernie Sanders tweet about Game Workers Unite.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Which is wild. Seeing real talk, seeing like Jocelyn from Riot, who was one of the women who organized the walkout at Riot, and Emma from Game Workers Unite sit on the giant bomb couch and talk about what a union is. Like, that stuff is actually genuinely exciting and new because the conversations and the attempts at resistance and organization that have happened behind the scenes and often been shut down are now happening out in public. People have been making independent small games in their bedrooms for as long as any of us have been alive. Yeah. It's just that we called those mods or they existed on forums on the internet and we didn't think about them or they happened in ZZT. Like, they were all – people have always been doing independent game development for as long as games have existed.
Right.
House rules, all that shit. But now platforms like Itch have brought those to more people. Companies who are pressured to have software on their consoles have – been pushed to include them in their kind of big press briefings. You know, to quote a man I love very dearly, I don't know that there's ever been a better time to play video games. It's just also the case that stuff is marred by a lot of bad shit too, and it always has been. Just that stuff is coming to light. And I think we need to like take that in stride and know that that's part of the industry getting better.
Right.
As more and more cool people, diverse people enter the medium and get to share their work. And like, I'm excited for that. Even if E3 exhausted me this year, even if E3 was a disappointment this year, I think 2020 is going to be a fucking cool year to play video games.
Yeah. I feel like also part of that is as more independent developers get more visibility and more of those people tend to start one way or another, either going to other companies or just getting more money or interest, like being able to make bigger things, like from a more diverse set of creators.
Yes.
Is very exciting to see.
Yes.
Going forward.
Patrick, 2020 in video games.
Yeah.
Discourse. Capital D Discourse is going to come for us. We're going to be in it all year.
I can already see this console generation is the worst one because it just gave us faster load times and nothing else.
That's fine, though. Like, I'm good. Like,
right.
I'm I'm ready to be past the hardware discourse just in on the games.
Mm-hmm. Totally. But, like, there will be people who are like, what? This is a new generation. This is what next gen is now? I can feel it rippling.
Yeah, I guess it's not like a hot take, but like just like I'm part of the reason I'm so curious about next year, because like this is true of any sort of like generational turnover, is like this is when you get a lot of, you know, big new swings on IPs, on worlds, like things you're going to be playing sequels of for, you know, the next 5 to 8 years. And it's like, what has been, you know, as we've talked just here about like the shift in what we're talking about, like what games are considering, what their values are. Right. The beginning of a new generational cycle is an instance in which we, in some ways, we get a measuring stick on where has that caught up in the big machine, in which the big machine will never be perfect. The big machine will never be as interesting, varied, progressive, thoughtful as what is happening in independent spaces that are, are freer and have more latitude and don't have to worry about the expectations of fidelity in the same way that is expected of AAA games. But I do think it provides a sense of like, well, what are the priorities of these companies? What do they think that we want and want from games in these types of games? And I think it takes a long time for change to appear in those games because it's so long for them to be developed. They tend to appear less in sequels and more in like, here is the, you know, it's less likely to see what's happening like in Watch Dogs, where it feels like its politics and its aim has changed actually pretty dramatically over the course of three games in really interesting ways. But that feels less of what we see and more of an outlier.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, like, what do Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo to a lesser extent, because that's really just not the world they play in nearly as much. No. But like for these big like story-based things that are supposed to reflect what we want to play or what we think we want to play, or what they think we want to play, what do they think that is? Like, what is the mirror that they think they're holding up to us, and where does that stuff fall? That's where I'm curious to see so much about next year that I don't know, have much visibility into, but I'm so deeply curious to see where it lands.
Me too. And on that note, I'm exhausted again. E3 has tired me out, not once, but twice.
And that let's do one podcast more time. 4 hours later, let's do two podcasts.
Let's just do two. Let's just go until 4 a.m., baby. That's going to do for us. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Kato?
At @A_Kato_appears.
Patrick Klepek, who just went blurry on our camera for a second.
This is the aliens. This is
the aliens. The alien con. They came through right now.
If you want a clear signal, you need to pay $635 for the Galaxy Pass.
Which you can find the day that this comes out, Alien Con is going on. So, have fun, everybody. Find everything Waypoint does: waypoint.vice.com, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. We'll be back on Monday with another episode of Waypoint Radio, and we're going to try to figure out this Ava podcast.
Something's going to happen, right?
Something's going to happen. We're going to figure something out. So look forward to that in the coming weeks. Until then, peace.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.